on Long Island. The state's Liquor Authority Board will be meeting today to decide on the possible suspension of some licenses. You can find more stories on our website, WXXINews.org, and on the WXXI mobile app.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Bob Johnson Chevrolet, proud supporter of Connections with Evan Dawson, believing an informed public makes for a stronger community. BobJohnsonChevy.com.
From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made during rush hour on a city bus. And yes, we're talking about non-pandemic times. As one passenger writes about the experience, quote, "Dressed conservatively in a tweed jacket and tastefully bold tie, I am an unremarkable man on an unremembered train, as unnoticed as any other commuter, except for one thing. Amid the growing crush, the seat beside me remains empty. At stop after stop, as people come on board, glance around, and seat themselves, a succession of seemingly random individual decisions coalesces into a glaring pattern of unoccupied spaces next to black males, including me. Soon, the seats beside us are the only ones left empty," end quote. That passenger is Bruce Jacobs, author of the book Race Manners. The work Assessing Racism in America provides a guide for how to recognize it and push back against the problems. Race Manners was originally published in 1999, and Jacobs writes that the behavior on the bus that he wrote about then seems to have diminished somewhat in the last 20 years, but certainly still exists and is more prominent in some parts of this country than others, especially in today's political climate and during this pandemic. Jacobs is a Rochester native, a Harvard graduate, a widely published poet, and a jazz drummer. On Wednesday, he'll do a virtual presentation for the Harley School. It's called Anti-Racism, Moving America Toward Democracy. He joins us this hour to preview that discussion and to talk about the impact of white supremacy on our political, economic, and social structures. We'll also discuss how to have civilized, candid, and meaningful dialogue about race. Bruce Jacobs, I'd say welcome to Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I know you've been on this program in previous iterations. It's nice to have you with me for the first time, sir.
It's a pleasure, Evan. It's good to be back, and it's good to talk with you about this. I'll also add that, yeah, I'm that passenger, and I wrote that. And I wrote that en route to where we are today, which is exponentially more serious and more high stakes than it even was then. But all those things remain true, and that's why we're here. So thanks.
Well, nice to have you, and I'll let our listeners know Wednesday. The event is the part of the Common Speaker Series at Harley. Obviously, they wish they could do all of this in person, but they are moving on to Zoom Wednesday, 6:30 p.m. to about 8 o'clock, 6:30 to 8 Wednesday night on Zoom. It is free, but registration is required on the Harley School's website. We'll have a link on our podcast page if you want to check that out here. Bruce, let our listeners know about your connection to Rochester.
I'm born and raised Rochesterian. My three sisters and I, the four of us, are all Rochester natives, happily so. Still spend a lot of time there. I come up, not as much as people would like me to, particularly people who are related to me, but I do come up. And a lot of times it's conveniently when the trout are spawning, running upstream from the lake, either in the spring or the fall. But I have family there, I have lifelong friends there. It's my hometown, man. It's where I'm from. I also understand, I just looked at the schedule, the hour after us is going to be discussing renaming Rochester because of the legacy of Nathaniel Rochester, which we were all taught in grade school, except we weren't taught those parts. And that sounds like an interesting conversation, too. I'm going to try to listen.
To be fair, Bruce, for some reason, we must have a bug in the schedule. That was a conversation that we just had at the end of last week. So we've had that one, and it's on there, and you can find it. Former Rochester Mayor Bill Johnson was one of the guests, and we had, a really interesting conversation about understanding our history. I think generally the conclusion was there's going to be reasonable people who agree and disagree on changing certain park names or street names, etc. But it is most important that we get history correct and we don't kind of tell ourselves fairy tales and allow for fairy tales anymore. And unfortunately, we've done that in so many cities and with so many ostensible heroes throughout the centuries.
I think that's right. That's good to hear. Well, I'll stay tuned. Thanks.
Well, and so, Bruce, let's talk about the word anti-racism itself here, because that's a word that you know, maybe in 1999, you know, was less in the culture. Now we hear the word anti-racism quite a bit, and I think it's important to define what we mean by that. How do you define it?
Yeah, I define it, and there are a lot of ways you can define it, but I think a basic working definition, and there are others who have much more succinct and I think ironclad definitions than mine. It's basically undoing and replacing white supremacy, both institutionally and culturally. Institutionally in terms of the policies, the actions, the physical realities, from basically authoritarian policing to anti-voting practices, which we're in the middle of right now on the part of a GOP, which would like to see a lot fewer people of color vote this coming November, and all of the socioeconomic policies that disenfranchise, effectively disenfranchise poor people and people of color in this country. Culturally, what parallels that is the whole sets of beliefs that underpin these white supremacist institutions and practices. And when you talk about anti-racism, you're talking about, I think, being consciously on a path to undoing both of those things and replacing them with what I'd call democracy, which is why that's the title of my talk.
And, you know, when you talk about cultural racism, or even, you know, growing up, I was taught about personal racism, and that's pretty much it. I mean, I grew up in a suburb of Cleveland, Ohio, and there was just almost nothing that I could remember, and I suspect nothing taught about structural racism at the time. And about 5 years ago, Bruce, I was talking to a friend who is a teacher in a local suburban district here in the Rochester area, and she said that her suburban school students were routinely telling her that, well, we don't even think racism really exists anymore because we've never heard anyone say the N-word seriously. That was the extent of how they defined what racism is, as opposed to understanding personal or individual racism, cultural racism, structural and systemic, and what the way those layers may sort of weave together. There was almost nothing. How much do you think has changed since 1999 when you first wrote this book, and even in the last 5 years? How much do you think the emphasis on actually educating effectively about the different forms of racism?
I think that's a great question, and I thought about it myself. I've had some trepidations, to be honest, coming back out on the road with this particular book, because I'm between books right now, although I'm writing essays and I'm putting stuff out there that reflects my sense of the current moment with all these things. But I had some trepidations because, number one, to be honest, I never really liked the title. We settled on it, but in retrospect, I wish I'd trusted my instinct about the title and gone with another one, which is to say, any authors out there, trust your instinct about how you label your work. Okay, just saying.
What would you have called the book, Bruce?
Well, there were a lot of things, and one of them might be the name of an upcoming podcast that I want to start. So I want to be mum about it right now.
Okay.
But the point is that book is from a certain time and place, as you said, and I think what is still true that's in that book, fundamentally true, which is why, even though the last edition was 2007, I think, people are still reading it and still contacting me about it, and it still resonates, is that on a certain level, the everyday experiences of racism in everyday life, including policing, haven't changed much. What has changed, among other things, is cell phone technology. That has made that a proven reality for people who could afford to choose to not believe it. Folks like me couldn't choose to not believe it because I'm a person of color, an African American. So I think the fundamental truth that the real problem isn't bad personhood, it's bad ideas, bad policy, and bad societal structure, I think remains bedrock. I think that's true, and that's what we're building on right now. What's changed, I think, are two huge things, which is that number one, the very checks and balances on governance and discourse in the United States are now broken. I say without reservation that this is a failed state. It is an utterly broken state that no longer works, even in its purported role as a democracy. And most Americans, including a big chunk of the Trump electorate, know that, which is why they elected him. this is another conversation. So with that level of dysfunction, utter dysfunction from the top down with this regime that we have in place, which I think everyone within the range of my voice can see pretty clearly, and those who don't, that's probably a conversation that might not be that useful in this moment. But we are also at a point where we have an information ecosystem, most of it online, that is completely out of control with misinformation, to the point where the idea of an informed electorate is almost a bitter, tragic joke for tens of millions of Americans who believe the things that they do. And the role of mainstream media in terms of fact-checking the statements of powerful people who run government and who set policy has been marginalized in a lot of ways for a big chunk of the voting electorate. Those two things are putting us in an incredibly precarious position as a society. We are up against the wall. And it's kind of even money now whether the progressive kind of convergence that I see around the Black Lives Matter movement, Black Lives Matter movement, and basic issues of cultural and economic and political democracy, which are multiracial, which is why that movement looks that way, or a turn toward autocracy and outright dictatorship, which, as we've seen, because of convenient concessions made by both cowards and craven operatives who really care about nothing but power and position, we are nearing, dangerously nearing, that sort of proposition. And at a precarious moment like this, the stakes are way, way, way too high to leave this as a matter of conversation or as a matter of, well, we disagree about this. Well, the stakes of that disagreement are killing people.
And I want to follow up on this point so I understand exactly where you are on something, and then I want to connect it to something that you wrote in your book, if I could. When it comes to the people who elected this president, I will say, Bruce, that my employer has been very patient and lenient with me in that I don't host this program, as you know, and as our predecessor here on this program did not host this program just to have a microphone to sort of talk down from the mountaintop at the world. I'm trying to facilitate conversation and to better understand one another, and that's one of the foremost goals that we have. Can we understand people really clearly? And then what can we do with that understanding? Having said that, I don't view this president in political terms anymore. I don't think he is anything. Now, maybe the Republican Party has become him, but he wasn't a typical Republican or a conservative in any sort of meaningful way. I think he has built a career on the preservation and the growth of his own empire and power. And for some reason, he has been effective at convincing a political institution to sort of abrogate all of its other duties and get on board with that. Not all of it, but a lot. And that concerns me greatly. And I don't think I'm not trying to be sort of both sides and say, oh, there's good Republicans and bad, and there's good Democrats and bad. But I do think that this is something unique and that there is a concerning kind of moment here, because I don't sit here and root for politics on this program, but I am concerned. So having said that, when you talk about the voters who elevated this White House to where it is now, and you say that you think they voted that way because they see it the same way, that there were I guess what I want to ask you is, do you think that they are cognizant of what you see them voting to preserve and protect? And the reason I ask is because this past weekend I had a conversation with someone I've known for years, and she felt attacked by friends and family for her Trump support. And I said, well, explain it then better. You know, I know that you're feeling defensive, but explain it. And she said, I don't support him personally. I wouldn't want my kids to behave like him. But, you know, before this pandemic, he was doing a good job with the economy. He supports the military, and he's pro-life. And that's what matters to me. So how do you see those kind of comments, and how do you see sort of the electorate that put this in power?
Yeah, those are good questions. And I think those are questions that a lot of people who do what you do, which is the honorable job of being a steward of truth, are asking and should ask. And I want to back up a little bit just to set the stage for this, because That's really the premise of my talk on Wednesday. It's fundamentally what I'm going to talk about is literally how anti-racism is pro-democracy, the actual creation of democracy that doesn't exist in this country right now. I think what has, it's not so much that, and I want you to understand this, Evan, because I feel this from the heart. I was a journalist at one time. I worked for the Democrat and Chronicle as a reporter for a few years, and it was kind of my earliest underpinning as a social communicator. And that's one of the, it's part of the holy grail, I think, of public responsibility to do that well, the way that you want to do it and you do it. I think the problem is not that that ethic has gone away, although I think it has changed with corporate control of how news operations work. I think the problem is that it's, to some large extent, been supplanted by an online misinformation infrastructure that pulls people away from the kind of work that journalists like you do so that they don't even have to read it anymore. The people we're talking about, who are the core of what I would call the Trump cult, aren't even listening to you. They're not listening to us. They're living in an echo chamber created specifically online to command attention around fictional narratives for political reasons. Trump's people are involved with this effort. I know this pretty intimately because of the work that I do. But it's also part of a broader way of trying to create disorder and to trying to move a narrative forward that's better for white supremacy and that's better for a certain kind of corporate ethic of how you should run society. In other words, when people are preoccupied with this, they're less concerned about the Koch brothers and about other ways that democracy economically is being supplanted. And I do think that a big component of, it's not that even most Trump supporters look at him and say, he's a good guy, I'm going to vote for him, I want that. I think the operative element was that the society, the ways in which people need fundamental democratic small d fairness in wages, in the ability to retire with decency without being petrified with fear, in political enfranchisement, in policies that look like the things they actually want. Our current system has so distorted that and kind of destroyed even the myth of that for a lot of working white Americans without college degrees, which is the Trump electorate in large measure, it's not about liking him or liking, it's liking any kind of hammer that smashes what you think is a bad system and maybe creates an opening for better things to happen. It's that level of desperation. And what I'm saying to wrap it up in this talk is that this dysfunction, this utter breakage of this economy so that it does not serve people decently with decent wages, with health care, with political enfranchisement, and most people know it and are suffering and are angry about it. That dysfunction started 400 years ago with white supremacy and basically with a kind of fetishistic ethic that, you know, it created an attitude that white supremacy, when you add white supremacy and capitalism, you get this wickedly individualized ethic that, quote, white people are entitled, literally, to be treated better because they are titularly white. And that created the kind of ruthlessly, I would say societally suicidal, ruthlessly, recklessly individualized American ethic of being personally entitled to what you have, not caring about anybody else, and pushing ahead toward getting yours because you're entitled to get it. That's what's broken. That's why we have a plutocracy now instead of an economic democracy, with coveted wealth not looping back into the economy to serve people through higher wages and benefits and retirement and free health care. That's why we lag behind the entire rest of the industrialized world. We're barbaric in the developed world in terms of not having free health care and not having high quality free public education everywhere. The Trump electorate knows that. They're furious, they're desperate, and they're susceptible to Trump's pitch because it's easy to blame that on brown people who they think are sucking away resources. But it's not that they want black, it's not that they necessarily want brown people to suffer. It's that they're desperate for some solution for this broken state. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, and that's where the late political columnist Molly Ivins, she used to refer to Heartland voters as Bubba's, and she said she always loved Bubba. She didn't blame Bubba for the way Bubba voted. She always blamed the political manipulators who knew how to turn people against one another and used all kinds of different cudgels to do that without any interest other than preservation of their own concentration of wealth and power. And
right.
What we have now is a really inegalitarian society. Do you think a more egalitarian society would produce a different outcome 2016, 2020, and beyond here then, Bruce?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think if we had had a more egalitarian society that hadn't been poisoned with this fetishistic, me first, you know, prototypically American attitude about entitlement and relative power in relation to other citizens, me first, I think if we'd gone into 2016 or even gone into the 20th century with that sort of a real ethic among our citizenry, Trump wouldn't have had a chance. I don't think he even would have happened. He'd probably be in jail for his, you know, for all of the crooked things he's done as a real estate shyster. So it absolutely, I think that's right. It set the table for this breakage. I really do call it. It's a state of breakage, literally, that's at a catastrophic level right now. And that's the desperation you're seeing that's being funneled through racism, through anti-immigrant ideas, through Make America Great Again, aka Make America White Again. And I think the solution, if we were to put on the table all of the things that working people and people who want to work across all races want, I think a lot, I mean a lot, Evan, of what looks like racism right now would evaporate. Hmm. Because you wouldn't have this dog-eat-dog, it's got to be me first, that's the American way, and you're in my way, and I'm better, so get out and get down. That's the problem.
And this is where I want to connect it to your book, because you write about what you call undeniable truths. And there's a couple of them that stood out to me, because my read on this is that over the decades, there hasn't been enough reckoning with these undeniable truths, as you call them. One of them is this. You write, modern affirmative action was never meant to be completely painless for white people. That's hard for people to hear, because for a long time, I think I'm speaking very generally here, but I think the idea of affirmative action was sold as, it's going to be good for people of color, but it'll be good for everybody. It's not going to limit anybody else's opportunities. There's not going to be any cost to individuals. You're saying it was never meant to be completely painless for white people. And I want you to elaborate on that point, because I think that lack of understanding with some of that is part of how we end up in a society where people are feeling like, you know, they can't be asked to give an inch no matter what our history for the last 400 years has done.
Yeah. I think that's right, Evan. Thanks. I mean, really the underpinning that brought me to write Race Matters in the first place these years ago was that very reality. I mean, I'm walking around and I'm looking around and I'm saying, we're living in a fun house. This is a house of mirrors. This is a whole matrix of completely fictional, insidiously destructive and explicitly destructive narratives posing as societal truth, not only as truth, but as gospel in terms of this being a meritocracy, you know, this being more or less a racially equal opportunity situation, this being meritocratic. And the idea of affirmative action, as I wrote in Race Matters, and as I continue to say today, about all of these sorts of things, that all of these potential remedies for institutional white supremacy, like affirmative action, which is a great example, were never intended by definition to be painless for white people, because it is white supremacist structural realities, the built-in advantage from that day 400 years ago when racism became a useful national narrative to protect the money-making enterprise of slavery, right? From that moment forward, there's been this vested interest in pretending that institutionalized white privilege is meritocracy. Oh, everybody's got a fair chance. And, you know, if you've built the foundation of everything you think you depend on as a nation, all of the fabulous money that this nation and its economy have generated over the centuries, beginning with slavery, which is really where the capital came from that built all of the major later corporations in this economy. It isn't talked about much, but it's true. And we need to be talking about that front and center. And so, yeah, you can't. It's physics. You can't correct the institutional inaccuracies and distortions of white privilege. You can't correct the built-in, you know, having two different starting lines for people in a race. You can't correct that physical problem without changing physical realities. You can't just say, okay, well, I still started ahead of you, but we'll leave the finish line here. you don't get to do that. And that's a real cultural problem for America, because fundamentally, you know, this country is, you know, I should say, the kind of inherited fabric, let's say, of the American narrative is physically built to not be able to rip itself asunder and to look at that and to say, oh gosh, you know, this basic thing on which we built this foundation was a lie. It was always a lie. So we're going to tear that lie down and we're going to start again with something that looks like meritocracy. And meanwhile, for those of you who suffered because of that inequality, we're going to do some things to correct the distortion so that you have something more like an equal chance, which is what affirmative action is.
And
in the best of worlds, it's temporary. Because what we really need to do is get to what's underneath it and change that.
Certainly. And as would be reparations, as an example. You write, policies of racial compensation do carry a price, whether that is, you know, affirmative action, but also proposed measures like reparations, which get a lot more currency these days than maybe they did in 1999. I don't know how you feel about that.
Yeah, they do. They do, and they should. And that's because at a certain point, enough is enough. And I think it's a combination of the fundamental breakage that I've been talking about, the fact that we have literally, quite literally, a criminal administration in the White House that cares nothing about the Constitution, about constitutionality. I mean, we could tick off all of the autocratic and flagrantly illegal continual outrages of the Trump administration. But I won't, because we don't have time. There's an organization that actually indexes them that has a running list of Trump's conflict of interest. The last time I looked at the list of these legal conflicts of interest, it was up to 3,000 something, which is just unprecedented. It's just astonishing. It's like science fiction, but it's true. And that's where we are now. So I think it's upped the ante on everything. It's up the ante for those who really feel that, you know, their stature in the hierarchy of white supremacy is non-negotiable and they'll have to die giving it up. And those of us who are dedicated to and will work unflinchingly until we bring about a true egalitarian democracy, both economically and politically and culturally. And I think the irony is that is, as you start to unpack what that democracy looks like, you'll see a whole lot of people who right now declare themselves for Trump saying, you know, I want that too. Yeah, you're right. We need to do it that way. And a lot of the grievances start to peel off when you actually provide an outlet. which our system hasn't done very well with two corporate-sponsored parties.
Well, and this is where, after our only break of the hour, I'm going to come back with Bruce Jacobs, the author of Race Manners for the 21st Century, who is our guest for the hour. He's a Rochester native, by the way. And this is where I think Bruce's book is apart from a group of books on race in recent years. And in fact, the Atlantic Monthly took a hard look at what the best-selling list has been and looked at a common thread, and they found a weakness that I think Bruce's book doesn't have, that these books kind of do. And I am curious to know what Bruce thinks about that, because his book, if you haven't heard of it, it's Race Manners for the 21st Century, came out in 1999. That may be why you might say, oh, I've heard of White Fragility, and I've heard of a number of these other books. But Bruce's book is Race Manners, and he has an event on Wednesday night with the Harley School. Now, can't be here in person, but it's going to be free on Zoom Wednesday night, 6:30 to 8 p.m. But they do ask that you register in advance on the Harley School's website. We'll link to that on our podcast page if you want to check it out. This is our only break, and we're right back with Bruce Jacobs. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So, Bruce, the Atlantic has been looking at the bestsellers, and there's a lot topped by Robin DiAngelo's book, White Fragility, on the recent list. But they're finding some common threads. One of them is this idea that we are inexorably bending toward the path of justice and that there's going to be bumps on the road, but we'll get there eventually. Let me quote from a piece called The Mythology of Racial Progress by Jennifer Richeson, who's a professor of psychology at Yale. She writes the following, quote, "Since the nation's founding, its prevailing cultural sensibility has been optimistic, future-oriented, sure of itself, and convinced of America's inherent goodness. Despite our tragic racial history, Americans generally believe that the country has made and continues to make steady progress toward racial equality. Broad acceptance of this trajectory underlies the way our leaders talk. It also influences the way racism is treated in popular culture. When we think about the nation's racial history, we often envision a linear path, one that admittedly begins in a shameful period but moves unerringly in a single direction toward equality. The narrative of racial progress starts with slavery, ascends to the Civil War and the Emancipation Proclamation, speeds past segregation and Jim Crow to the victories of the Civil Rights Movement, and then drops us off in 2008 for Barack Obama's election. Many people asserted at the time that America had become a post-racial society, or was at least getting close, maybe one short escalator ride away. This redemptive narrative not only smooths over the past, but smooths over what is yet to come. It holds out the promise of an almost predestined, naturally occurring future that will be even more just and egalitarian. Well, thinking this way won't make the future better." End quote. Do you agree with that, Bruce?
I do agree with that, and I'm glad you cited all of the viewpoints that you did in that passage. I agree with it very much, and I want to reply with something, after which I want to mention the names of two seminal writers right now who I think are getting this right and who I think are really, really important for us to use as touchstones, because they've become touchstones for me. But I think this is part of the problem. When you start with the practical necessity for white supremacy in order to run the slave industry, and then you make that a built-in, boiled-in, inherent ethic of what you think of or claim to be American meritocracy moving forward, without going back, once you see, well, you've always known that it was a lie, but there's this built-in denial from the beginning. And it's that very denial that has brought us to, you know, the yet another explosive point where we are right now. I mean, one of the ways I like to put it, Evan, is that Black Americans, of whom I am one, have lived in an authoritarian, largely authoritarian police state for 400 years, much of which remains unchanged, particularly if you're poor and Black or a person of color in general. But more wickedly if you're poor, but universally for all of us, in terms of how we are treated by police, in terms of random search, in terms of presumed right to violent excess in dealing with us by institutional authority, and in terms of how policy treats us and allocates resources to us. And that remains true regardless of all of the progress we've made, undeniably amazing, great progress, including the presidency of Barack Obama, with whom I had huge problems on levels of policy and on levels, I think, of needing to be a little bit too much of a nice black man for what was needed. And that's systemic as well. But that's brought us to this point where that baked in me first ethic of white supremacy not only poisoned the economy for all in terms of sharing resources, which is what a healthy economic democracy looks like, but particularly has kept it essentially a fascist state for me. When I look in my mirror and see red lights behind me on the highway, the reality is much closer to what you would call an autocracy than it is for a white person in that same situation. But the opportunity now, I think, and this is part of what I'll talk about in the talk on Wednesday, is that we're now at a moment where the raw greed of this kind of excess, this me-first ethic that goes back 400 years, has so broken American capitalism that now even more and more and more formerly middle class and working class white people are desperately up in arms about their own futures, mm-hmm. their own basic survival economically. And that creates the point of a spear of what I think can be an incredible progressive populist movement moving forward. I'll stop that there. I'll talk more about that in the talk. But I think everything you've pointed to is true, Evan. And I think that's the direction that it's taking the country. And I want to mention in that vein, yeah. two writers, mm-hmm. if you want to interject something, go.
No. This is exactly where I'd hoped you'd go, because if you could mention those writers and then a listener named Gail emailed to say, could you also recommend news sources that you follow or listen to?
Absolutely. Sure. Two writers, quickly. Actually, three. One is Ibram Kendi. A lot of people are probably familiar with his book. It's called Stamped from the Beginning. It is a tome. It's about a 400-page book. But read it. I'm in it, and I think it's indispensable. It's essentially a history of cultural and institutional racism in the United States from the beginning till now. It's a massive undertaking, and I think it's a must-read because it quantifies and actually, you know, shows how the lumber is nailed down on the structure of racism over a period of centuries, institutionally. Another person I'd recommend is named Eddie Glaud. He's at Princeton. He's a professor at Princeton. Last name is G-L-A-U-D-E, Eddie Glaud, Jr. I've learned of him recently. He's got a book out about James Baldwin, the great humanist and social justice crusader James Baldwin. His book is called Beginning Again, but what he really is talking about is bringing this whole structure of inequity down to earth in real terms that we can all understand. And I think he's a brilliant voice in moving us in this direction toward democracy. And the last person I'll mention is a writer named Amanda Marcotte, M like Morris, A-R-C-O-T-T-E. She writes for Salon. But she also does her own stuff, and she has a book out about online kind of subcultures. And she's the most eloquent writer I've ever seen on the particular phenomenon of how do you talk to essentially right, far-right cult members in this day of utter toxicity where saying the wrong thing gets you shot. And her prescription is essentially you don't. But it's more complicated than that. And I think it's really worth a read because she explores these things on a personal as well as a political level on how they work and how we can actually make communication mm-hmm. work or save our breath when we need to do something that matters more to change things.
I'm not trying to say this with any snark at all. I'm just observing a kind of irony in that a lot of the criticism of social justice movements and some of these efforts, whether it's Black Lives Matter or others, is that, well, everyone's addicted to identity, the critics say. There's too much identity. But the steadfast support of President Trump, for example, is not only a really good distillation of what I think of the power of identity. Because if you're a Trump supporter, you identify yourself in that way so powerfully. And again, I'm not saying it critically, I'm just observing. But so much so that the president, people thought he was joking when he said this, but he was just observing something about the identity and the strength of that support when he said that I could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and people would still vote for me. That's what it means. And when you say cult, I hear you saying this is just a group that is so beholden to identity that almost nothing else matters.
No. I think that's right, but I think that's half of it, Evan.
Okay.
It's absolutely right that this is a group that is mesmerized by identity. Trump is, I call Trump sort of a political poet in a way. I'm a poet myself. And I think he has a really underestimated gift for closing his eyes in front of an audience that wants what they want from him and knowing how to give it to him. And he gives it to them in just the way they need it given. I think he's brilliant at that, in spite of his being a vile human being and an idiot. He's brilliant at doing that particular thing, which is all about a sort of perceived identity and a perceived usness, right? But the need for that identity is based on institutions and physical realities to which people are desperately attached. And in this case, I think it's a combination of wanting to preserve. It's not a coincidence that the slogan is Make America Great Again, right? It's take it back to when certain institutional things of white privilege were unquestioned, when white privilege wasn't challenged, when you didn't have to worry about other people demanding more of their share economically and politically. That's what that means. And that's about policy. That's about physical reality. That's about societal structure. Same thing with Black Lives Matter. I mean, yeah, you can look at that, and I think it's easy for some. You're not doing this, because we're having a far different, deeper conversation. But I think it's easy for some, and some do, look at BLM as a movement and define it as a black identity movement. No. It's a movement for justice that happens to involve black people because we are targeted for injustice by policies, by actions, by structures, by where money goes for schools, by where money goes for policing, by who's in jail, by who's not in jail, by how the law is carried out, by what the law is. See? And I think those are the two halves of this equation. So the identity stuff is a manifestation of what pisses people off, which is material stuff that's happening that violates their sense of what they deserve. And that there's an aspect of that that's an entitled sense of wanting to return to the old days of more ritualized, practical white privilege. Mm. We're never going to go back there. And that's part of what's fueling, I think, the desperation. But it's about reality. It's not just about ideas and identity.
Your book addresses an email that I just got from a listener, so I'll read the email. There's a section of your book where you urge people to talk about issues, not individuals. The first thing I thought of immediately when I read that was, it's going to sound strange, but I'm a Clevelander, but I thought of LeBron James. Because once in a while you will hear people, usually white people, say, well, you can't tell me that the system is rigged against anybody because LeBron James came from nothing and look at that guy. Which, I mean, if you're going to point to LeBron James as sort of an example that anybody could make it, that's a little bit, like the physically superior lottery. I don't think that that's necessarily a great example, but people do it. But again, your book urges, don't just focus on individuals or one-offs or anecdotes, talk about issues. In that same thread here, let me read this email from Jim. He says, your guest is feeding a false narrative that presupposes people of color are at an inherent disadvantage from birth because of systemic racism. It's garbage. Any person of any color can and does succeed in this country. I work in a good-paying trade and have and continue to work alongside black men. Every one of them will tell you it's your decisions and work ethic that determine your fate. That's from Jim. Bruce?
Well, Jim, you've drunk the Kool-Aid, and I can't help you with that. What I can tell you is that the falsity, the utter falsity, and it's tragic that you cling to that falsity, will be disproven without your agreement. We'd love to have you with us as we dismantle these levels of hypocrisy and injustice and as we move this toward being a democracy, but we'll do it without you, Jim. We will do it without you, and hopefully you'll join us when you're ready. There's more important work to be done than having a prolonged argument with any one person about this, because we have a movement that's desperately needed in this moment for the immediate future of the country. And I think that's all I need to say.
Let me also address maybe the best-selling book since the pandemic. Well, really, not just since the pandemic, but since the killing of George Floyd, and that's Robin DiAngelo's White Fragility. And The Atlantic has sort of zeroed in on a book that numerous writers under that publication feel is viewed with too much reverence. Let me read one of the criticisms, and I'd like to get your take. And I think where it departs from your book is that you talk about these issues of possible policy. You talk about sort of the tangible issues that are difficult to engage with, everything from affirmative action, reparations like we've talked about, but also effects of systems. The criticisms from The Atlantic about DiAngelo's book is that it is prescriptive only in that certain people should feel badly or should stop saying certain things, but there's not a whole lot of movement forward. Here's what John McWhorter writes about White Fragility. Quote, this is what he writes. He says, it treats black people like children and further divides us. We must consider what is required to pass muster as a non-fragile white person in Robin DiAngelo's world. If you're a white person and you refer to a bad neighborhood, you're using code for black. But if you call it a black neighborhood, then you're a racist. By DiAngelo's logic, you are not to describe such neighborhoods at all, even in your own head. You must not ask black people about their experiences and feelings because it's not their responsibility to educate you. Instead, you must consult books and websites. Never mind that upon doing this, you will be accused of holding actual black people at a remove, reading the wrong sources or drawing the wrong lessons from them. You must never cry in black people's presence as you explore racism, not even in sympathy, because then all the attention goes to you instead of black people. If you object to any of the feedback that DiAngelo offers about your racism, you are engaging in a type of bullying whose function is to obscure racism, protect white dominance, and regain white equilibrium. What is this all for? Well, the very assumption is deeply condescending to all proud black people, and this dehumanizes us, period, end quote. That's John McWhorter. What do you make of that, Bruce?
I think it's nonsense, to be honest. And it's nonsense because, you know, it's sort of classic red herring stuff, Evan. What you do is you take an argument, you take a certain aspect of something, in this case, white fragility, which is an emotional state of feeling vulnerable all the time that's hard for a lot of white people to deal with in terms of culpability. And you magnify that and blow it up entirely out of proportion until it looks like something crazy. And what you conveniently leave out of the equation is the context that creates that fragility in the first place, which is that the things that white people feel self-conscious about are things that happened that are based on racist institutions, racist practices, you know, a legacy of white people being invisibly advantaged in a zillion ways that by definition they never know because they can't see them. They think it's invisible to them because the stuff that happens to brown people doesn't happen to them. And that's systemic. That's structural. You know, I don't want to dwell too much on the white fragility thing because, to be honest, I think this sort of blowing smoke is trivial about how people should act responsibly to move toward racial justice. What this is about is what policy looks like, what the society looks like, where the resources go, who gets the schools and who doesn't. Right? Who gets health care and who doesn't? In this case, nobody in America gets decent health care. It's just that white people get not enough and black people get far more not enough, to butcher that particular term, but you know what I mean. So I think, you know, we're going to have smoke blown like that all the time, but the work that we really, really need to do is to change the realities that create a situation where white people feel completely, continually accosted about institutional racism by the people who are affected by institutional racism. And that doesn't change until you change the institutions, the laws, and the practices, which go back 400 years.
All right, Bruce, our last 45 seconds. Gail wants to know, thanks for the book suggestions. Can you suggest journalists and media that you trust?
Yeah, I think among mainstream media, I think, and it might surprise some people, I think CNN is pretty good. CNN, after shying away from some time for calling out untruths and blatant lies and hypocrisies from politicians of you know, all stripes, has gotten much better at that. And I think they're fairly trustworthy. I would also highly recommend an online publication called Popular Information. It's written by a guy named Judd, J-U-D-D, Legum, L-E-G-U-M. They were, you know, among others, the outlet that broke widely the story about Disney underwriting ads on Tucker Carlson's show on Fox, which is a monstrously racist and distortive and, you know, just sort of broadcaster of this online nonsense we've been talking about, and caused Disney and some other big companies, including T-Mobile, to divest, to really stop advertising, at least for a month, on Tucker Carlson's show. In fact, I think they divested permanently. Mm-hmm. So those are two that I would suggest, Popular Information and CNN, if you're going mainstream. But there are others.
Bruce Jacobs is the author of Race Manners for the 21st Century, Wednesday night, 6:30 to 8 on Zoom with the Harley School. It's free. It's part of their Common Speaker Series. Go to the Harley School's website if you can register in advance if you are interested. And Bruce, thanks for making time with your hometown NPR station. It's nice to have you.
I appreciate it, Evan. It's a pleasure. Take it easy.
Bruce Jacobs. All right, more connections coming up.
This program is a production of WXXI Public Radio. The views expressed